Radio MD. RadioMD.com.
Get healthy, be healthy, stay healthy. It's the Power of Health with Dr. Jeffrey Burke.
I'm back with Natasha Trenev, and we're talking about our guts. And we're talking about how to get the skinny on our gut health and also learning maybe a little bit about gut terminology. You know, Natasha, a lot of words are thrown around a lot today, and I think a lot of people intermingle them together, and they truly are different worlds, like microbiota and microbes and microbiome. Three different words, three different meanings, but sometimes put into the same category. And we are reading about them. My people are starting to educate themselves. Maybe a little bit of a breakdown of the definitions, because, of course, learning the definitions to words will help us learn better.
Right. Well, just so people understand, the digestive system is the cornerstone of well-being and your total health. So understanding how the microbes in our gut interact with this digestion process is probably the most important thing you need to learn and understand. So having said that, you know, we have to understand the words that are thrown out at us. So let's go for it. Before, you know, 40, 50 years ago, even 20 years ago, we used to call the microbes, which includes bacteria, yeast, and viruses in our gut, the flora. That was a term that was used prevalently, especially in the alternative healthcare industry and the dietary supplement industry. However, because science has now rediscovered the importance of these microbes in our gut that are literally 10 times more than this, than our cellular structure of the body, they've come to the realization that we need better descriptive phrases so that people can adopt them and understand what we're talking about. So here we go. So if somebody tells you, calls something the microbiota, it's a word that means, you know, the composition of various microorganisms found in our gastrointestinal tract, which totals, as I told you, 100 trillion microbes, which includes bacteria, yeast, and viruses. So the number of bacteria found in the gut microbiota is about 100 trillion, a figure that is about 10 times more than the number of human cells in our body. So again, the microbiota is the total number of microbes that line the approximately 27 to 30 feet of our GI tract, which if it was, if the GI tract was laid out, it would cover the size of a tennis court. So that's very important for you to understand that composition of that microbiota. Now, if you were to take that microbiota and weigh it, it would actually weigh more than your brain. You know, we have estimates anywhere from 3 to 4 pounds. So that tells you that even though they're microscopic, how imperative they are to the function of our bodies and our health. Now, the microbiome, which is bantered around in literature and people talk about it, is actually the collective DNA of all the microorganisms in our gut. And we have about 150 times as many genes in the microbiome as we do in our own human genome. This is, you know, revolutionary. People don't understand that the microbiome gene pool really affects 99% of our genetic expression. So we really have to become much more familiar with this microbiota in our gut if we are going to attain and maintain health. And last but not least, there's a word that you probably won't see a lot now, but in the future you will see. It's called metabolomics, and it's really the study of the byproducts produced by the gut microbiota. So in other words, when the organisms in your gut are interacting with the food and other substances that are available for them to digest, they produce byproducts. Now, if they're friendly bacteria, they're going to produce metabolites and things that are essential to our good health. But harmful microorganisms produce bad compounds that actually can harm us and compromise our health. So that study of which organisms are producing the healthy compounds and which organisms are producing the unhealthy compounds is called metabolomics. And so the metabolites is the word that describes the chemicals or substances produced as a byproduct of metabolism. In other words, what is metabolism? Metabolism is the breaking down of food components into the proper molecular size so that our bodies can be nourished. I hope that was a sufficient explanation.
That was a great explanation. Isn't it amazing that they all start with M?
Yes, and I didn't. It wasn't by my design.
So this metabolomics, this is a word that people are going to start to hear now, and it's more of the study of the products that are produced when they interact with food, and the healthy bacteria will produce healthy byproducts, and once again, the unhealthy bacteria will produce unhealthy byproducts. So
that's right, and so it's also known in literature and something that is found in nature and products exclusively. It's called a supernatant, when the bacteria are grown in a specific material that we know they like. They will produce compounds that are beneficial to our health, and that's found in what we call the intrinsic supernatant, or the original growth medium that the bacteria are grown. So the science is very complex, and you really have to know your business in order to produce the most effective microorganisms and their compounds that people can ingest to improve their health.
Now, where do our food allergies today, you know, because people have a lot of imbalances and food allergy problems, and I think a lot of the food allergies we have are probably self-induced by the combinations and the blends and the weakening of our gut and the lack of absorbability and the incapability of being able to digest our food. But food allergies are a lot more common today, and I think that these food allergies, well, this is my personal feeling. I feel that when you're allergic to food and you don't have the capability of digesting the food, those seem to be the foods that we're craving and the ones that we want and the ones that we're eating, even though we shouldn't.
Right. Well, look, let me explain to you. That's about a two-hour lecture, so yeah. I'm going to try to condense it for our listeners so that they don't start yawning on me. You know, the gut lining is, you know, the barrier of the outside world for nutrients reaching the inside of our world to nourish us. So just think of it, the gut lining as your 27 to 30 foot tube, which we call the GI tract, is the gateway of matter or food entering into the bloodstream. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay, so on that gut lining, you have to really make certain that the healthy digestive system makes you feel good, perform well, accomplish more, and avoid illness. Doesn't that sound terrific?
It does.
But what happens when your immune cells are irritated on the gut lining because your body is not breaking down the nourishment or the food into the right molecular size, it causes irritation. And that irritation by the immune cells that are, you know, heavily located on our GI tract, about 70 to 80% of our immune cells are found in the lining of our GI tract, then they start reacting, and that's called an inflammation cycle. Inflammation is the warning sign the immune system gives us that, hey, you know, we have a problem down here, and I'm going to destroy those cells that are malfunctioning, and bingo, first you have a food sensitivity, and if that's not, you know, handled by you, then it becomes a full-blown food allergy, and in the case of peanuts, it can become so severe that even a minute amount can send a child or an adult into an anaphylactic shock. I hope that explains it.
Well, we know that food allergies can be quite intense. And I think sometimes people like the word probiotic, people throw around the word allergies, and sometimes it's their dislike of something where they say they have an allergy to it, they just don't like it. Because a true allergy can be, like you mentioned, life-threatening. And my question comes in is, if you do have these food allergies, and maybe you've had them for a long period of time during your life, if you support your digestive system, is there ever a chance that our body reacts differently to these foods once our inside gut is healthy, or do we have them for life?
It depends on your body, depends on how you change your diet, and depends on how you're able to successfully change the composition of the microbiota that's in your gut. Those are all the three variables. For instance, some people's allergies happen because when they're born, and even if they're breastfed, the child is not given the right bacteria that acts as a mitigator to make sure that there's something called tolerance developed by the immune cells on the gut lining that allow the passage, especially of protein molecules across the intestinal wall into the bloodstream. And when that tolerance is not established early on in life, that's when we become susceptible to larger molecules of protein transgressing and causing the immune system to overreact. So sometimes we have to get rid of the offending food, and we have to try to adjust our microbiota and, you know, at a later date, try to slowly reintroduce this food and see if our body can tolerate it. In some instances, you know, people never overcome a severe allergy like to peanuts. There's one theory about peanut allergies that's interesting, because peanut was a crop that was the most heavily pesticide laden. And the theory is that first the immune system reacts to the pesticides, and when that's not removed, then it starts reacting to the carrier of the pesticide, which is the peanut itself. And that's why the body becomes, you know, very hostile to introduction of anything resembling that problem that was tolerated by the body at an earlier age. Does that make sense?
It does. Are most of the food allergies across the board today pretty much the same food allergies we've had for, you know, a decade or so?
No. Now we're seeing what I call a literal explosion of gluten sensitivity. And one of the reasons, you know, some of the reasons that were noted for the gluten sensitivity is the destruction of the microbiota ecosystem by indiscriminate use of antibiotics and the consumption of junk food, which, as I said, has a large percentage of gluten in as a filler in meat products. And the inability of the body to tolerate that amount of gluten inside the GI tract. And also the other theory is the hybridization of wheat in America and then the making of the wheat into a GMO manufactured product. Probably the whole a combination of these reasons have led to this gluten intolerance. Now, we find that when people go to places like Italy or France, they don't have the same problem with the bread as they do in this country. Now, I'm not saying if you have a full-blown, you know, a gluten sensitivity or if you have celiac disease that you should fly to Italy and consume large amounts of pizza. What I'm saying is it's interesting to note why this change has occurred, and we have to really dig down to figure out how to reverse it because, you know, if you follow this trend in our country, we're becoming allergic to everything. If you recall that people were, you know, ingesting soy products in the 80s and the 90s, you know, tofu was big, soy milk was big. All of a sudden now, you know, soy food is not popular, so we're all, you know, consuming large amounts of nut milk, such as almond milk. But the thing is that, you know, nobody knows how our body is able to tolerate these new substances because we don't have a large historical use. Yeah, we have a historical use in the consumption of almonds and other nuts, but we don't have a long history of the consumption of the milks made from these products. And again, I'm going back that in westernized countries, the bacteria called Bifidobacterium infantis, in which I have promoted and sold for over 25 years, is the most important bacteria that needs to be in a newly born infant gut to help that, you know, what we call the downregulation of the immune system. And the reason we know that this is the most important bacteria is because we know from studies published by professors and clinicians at UC Davis, California, that breast milk has evolved over hundreds of years to provide the specific nutrients to stimulate this bacteria. The tragedy is that this bacteria has disappeared in the infants of guts born in westernized countries. So I think you can pinpoint the problem right there because we know that this bacteria is very important to, you know, build tolerance on the immune system site. And we know that, for instance, in third world countries, this bacteria is found readily in newborn infants and that they have less allergic reactions to the substances that we do in our westernized world. And then the doctors came up with something called the germ theory and said, oh, our infants are not exposed to enough germs, so they can't develop, you know, that's why they're so allergic to everything. And I said, yeah, the germ theory may be, you know, part of the answer, But the most of the answer is that if you don't have a good microbiota and you introduce the child to, you know, an environment that's not so clean, you could have a problem, because there's ample proof that children who were on antibiotics and consumed, you know, sand from a sandbox developed a disease. So, you know, it's, again, it's like people throwing their theories with a dart on a board, but not giving you the complete picture so that you can evaluate how we can change the situation around.
You know, the thing that perplexes me most of the time is that our lives can be so dramatically changed by making adjustments that we should already be doing, like exercise and good sleep and drinking water and eating food and chewing our food. And the addition of a quality probiotic can be so life-changing for so many people. And yet it's one of the things that people have a tendency to gravitate to last rather than first and primary.
Yeah, unfortunately for most people, you know, microbiology is a difficult science, and probiotics is complex. So people like to, you know, what I call just repeat what they've heard without actually having any ability to critically evaluate the information. So I make it very simple. Like I said, I've been in this field for 45 years, and the probiotic labeling standard was accepted by the entire health food industry, and it was read into congressional record as the health food industry solemn promise to the American public that we were going to self-regulate by adhering to a very simple, you know, labeling standard in all the categories of dietary supplements, but specifically probiotics. So one of the things that people should be looking for is, you know, a specific listing in potency of each organism listed on that probiotic label. And what is that organism in that product for? What is the function of that microorganism? Don't just buy a product that lists a bunch of microorganisms and gives you a total potency. It's totally useless, because if you don't know what the function of that bacteria is into this complex gut ecology that has 100 trillion microbes, and bacteria specifically are very intelligent entities, they're not going to do anything that's not in their interest. So whatever the so-called manufacturer, and 99% of these people don't even make the product they sell. So when you're buying a product, make sure that you know that the organism listed on the label is measured in potency for each organism, and that the manufacturer tells you what is the purpose of that organism being in that product. I think it just makes common sense, and I can't understand how people would buy something that lists 10, 20 microorganisms, and then they give you a total potency count, and you have no idea what those organisms are in there for, or if they can do any good for you. That's number one. Number two, there's a lot of games played with storage suggestions. Well, the storage suggestions and the appearance of the concept of shelf stability is one of the worst things that's ever happened in our dietary supplement industry, because when they talk about shelf-stable probiotics, they're talking about probiotic products that are stable at, you know, laboratory temperatures of 70 or 72 degrees Fahrenheit. There is no such temperature once the product is put in a hot warehouse or distributed where there's this great fluctuation of temperatures, whether it's cold or hot. So without specific handling directions during the lifetime of the product before it reaches the consumer, any of those statements are completely misleading, and you're wasting your money. And I think it's too important of a category for a consumer not to understand what they're buying and what they're ingesting, because you're ingesting living microbes, and that you're hoping is going to help the diversity of your gut flora. And the biggest misconception is that you're going to increase your diversity by buying a multi-strain product. But if you don't know if the organism is in the product or what the potency of that organism is, how are you going to help the diversity of your, you know, colonies of bacteria that live in your GI tract? So you see, it's a very simple thing. And you can get, you can view the simple probiotic labeling standard. It's available at the Natron website. And I'm going to make it available across the board to people in the U.S. because it's too important of a thing to miss. And it's not just something that I wrote It was voted on by the entire health food industry. It's meant to give you guidelines so that you know what beneficial probiotic bacteria you're ingesting, because the health of our nation needs to be improved. It's in drastically bad shape, and we need to change things.
Do you feel that we're going to get to the part where this is not going to be, I mean, today using probiotics, there's still a lot of people that are healthy, that are adopting the idea of a healthy probiotic, but the growing field of people that are gut unhealthy is dramatically increasing almost to an epidemic level, and the gastroenterologist offices are a good sign of that, as well are all the quick fixes in the drugstore down the gastrointestinal quick fix aisle. So, I mean, I see it growing and growing and growing, and I also see the range of individuals out there age-wise, from the young all the way to the elderly, now with digestive problems. I'm wondering when we're going to get a grip on it, and we're all going to have that aha moment, and we're going to realize that the probiotics are the first stop, not the last.
Exactly. And if we don't know what we're ingesting, or if whether it can survive handling and shelf life, and if it can survive stomach acid. Remember, I said in my earlier podcast that the stomach acid is there for twofold reasons. One is to digest the protein, and the other is a barrier against microbes reaching the small intestine. The same thing is true of probiotics. If they don't have a specific carrier that's been tested by a third-party agency, then you have no idea whether or not this large count that people claim of their so-called probiotic products is going to survive the GI tract. So you see again that people are just buying whatever they think sounds good. There's no evaluation at the store level or on websites. People just believe anything they hear, and there's nobody really telling them, hey, look, there has to be a probiotic standard, and the best one to start with is one that was written to congressional record, because I can't stress enough, Jeffrey, that the gut lining is the largest surface inside the human body. And the organisms living play a major role in the health and development of disease. That's the bottom line. If you don't understand the importance of the gut lining, and it's the largest surface inside the human body, and the importance these microbes play in our health, we've lost it. We're going to go down that path, and we're going to have more chronically ill people. And remember, all diseases, as I said 30 years ago, start with something going wrong in the GI tract.
Well, you know, I think the biggest misconception is that, and I mentioned this earlier, is that just changing the food can dramatically change your life. And although it's an amazing step in the right direction, you still have to be able to recognize it, digest it, assimilate it, break it down, and get it to the parts of the body that need to be benefited by that good quality food. And if your gut is compromised and you have no friendly, good, supportive, healthy bacteria, you may be spinning your wheels. And I always go into dismay myself, because I think to people that get frustrated, and here they are thinking, I finally changed my diet and I don't feel any different, but no one has told them about preparing their gut and healing their gut and bringing it back to the standards that it needs to be at to be able to do the job.
Exactly. And, you know, remember I promised in the last podcast, and we were coming down to the hour, to say, first of all, you have to have an individualized probiotic supplementation program. And yes, you can have diverse organisms, but you have to know which part of the GI tract you're targeting and how it's going to affect the ecology. So you need to have a customized probiotic supplementation system. And remember that, you know, yogurt is a probiotic food, and even kefir is a probiotic food. But forget the flavors. Think about, you know, just getting plain yogurt or plain kefir. That's what I call a probiotic functional food. In other words, it gives you more nutrients than if you just consume the milk or other product that's used to make this yogurt. So that's very important. And the other thing is broccoli. Broccoli is one of the number one foods to tame inflammation and help your health. Extra virgin olive oil, great for inflammation, something that you should have every day. Lentils. Lentils is a superfood. You know, eating 4 servings of legumes such as lentils weekly can really reduce inflammation, according to many studies. Salmon. You know, salmon is rich in omega-3s, and a wonderful food for anti-inflammation. You can make it into sandwiches, tacos, salads, or any kind of dish you want. Interestingly, grapefruit. You know, Americans used to consume grapefruit. Remember, grapefruits were a standard to eat every morning. I think a lot of us got away from it. So, you know, I will put up these foods on our website. So, Jeffrey, I'll let you finish up. The other ones are Brazil nuts and turmeric are the anti-inflammatory foods. And, of course, the right probiotic bacteria are your best defense against inflammation.
You know, we talked a lot today about inflammation. We talked about healthy foods. We talked about cravings. We talked about listening to our body, but we also talked about taking control, retraining, rebuilding, rejuvenating, and putting our body back in order. It's a lot of work, but you have to really think that if we don't put the time in and we don't put the work in, we're going to get to the point where we're not going to have the choice. And then choices are going to be made for us, and most of those are going to be pharmaceutical medications for symptomatic relief. Eating a good, healthy diet is brilliant. It's amazing. It's positive, and it's something that's essential. Bringing in your healthy probiotics and getting a good exercise program going, it's the healthy trinity, the three things that are the most important to get your body in healthy order. I'm Dr. Jeffrey Burke. This is The Power of Health on Radio MD. For more information on this show and to download the on-demand podcast segments, visit the show page at Radio MD. I thank you all for tuning in, and be well. Do something good today. Keep in mind that the small, tiny little changes that you make along the way can be dramatically life-changing. You don't have to run the marathon, but small little baby steps along the way can be amazing for monumental changes. Be well.